Ms. Brennan and Ms. Mullen, I would like to thank you both for your interest in the inquiry and for your appearance at today's hearing. The purpose of this hearing is to assist me in gathering evidence for the Climate Health WA inquiry into the impacts of climate change on health in Western Australia. My name is Taran Wiramantri and I've been appointed by the Chief Health Officer to undertake the inquiry. Beside me is Dr. Sarah Joyce, the inquiry's Project Director. If everyone could please be aware that the use of mobile phones and other recording devices is not permitted in this room, so if you could please make sure that your phone is on silent or switched off. This hearing is a formal procedure convened under Section 231 of the Public Health Act 2016. While you are not being asked to give your evidence under oath or affirmation, it is important you understand that there are penalties under the Act for knowingly providing a response or information that is false or misleading. This is a public hearing and a transcript of your evidence will be made for the public record. If you wish to make a confidential statement during today's proceedings, you should request that that part of your evidence be taken in private. You've previously been provided with inquiry's terms of reference and information on giving evidence to the inquiry. Before we begin, do you have any questions about today's hearing?
No, I don't.
No.
For the transcript, could I ask each of you to state your name and the capacity in which you are here today? And could I also ask that throughout the hearing, you briefly state your name prior to speaking so that the transcriber can be accurate?
I'm Pip Brennan, Executive Director of the Health Consumers Council.
And Claire Mullen, Engagement Manager of Health Consumers Council.
Thank you. Ms. Brennan, would you like to make a brief opening statement?
I was actually going to start with just a bit about the Health Consumers Council, if that's okay. So the Health is an independent, not-for-profit organisation. So it's established under our state incorporation law, and this year is our 25th year of operation. So we have a vision for equitable, person-centred, quality healthcare for all West Australians. And to achieve this vision, we undertake individual advocacy, and that also informs our systemic advocacy initiatives. And we undertake engagement activities with health service staff and consumers, carers and community members who want to become involved in improving our health system. So we train, network and support people who want to be at the service and at the policy table. I was the chair of the Consumer and Carer Reference Group of the Sustainable Health Review, and as such I was a panel member of that review. And as well as attending engagement activities throughout that project, the Health Consumers Council also advocated for and requested that more inclusive engagement activities be undertaken. We work in the regions, we work with Aboriginal communities, cultural and linguistically diverse communities in relation to the view of our state's health system, which resulted in the final report of the Sustainable Health Review.
Thank you, Sue. On the main Sustainable Health Review panel, as a member,
yes,
thank you,
correct, yeah.
And as well as the Consumer and Carer Reference Group.
Yes.
So you were familiar with the recommendations as they related to sustainability and, in fact, the commissioning of this inquiry?
Indeed, yes.
Thank you. I think we'll hear quite a bit about your relationship with patient groups, but you did also mention that you engage with staff in your organisation. What does that look like?
It's actually quite key, as you can imagine. It's important to work with staff to help them understand the benefits of and how to actually engage with consumers. So one of the things that the Health Consumers Council offers West Australia is that we have a seat at the table at a range of things. You know, the Sustainable Health Review is one example. Another example I was going to talk about was the Clinical Senate. So we have a seat at that table too. And it's about for us as an organisation, it's about us bringing a broader community perspective into the system. So we do a lot of work alongside the system. We're very much the partnership. In our vision, we talk about person-centred quality healthcare, and that references that there is a patient, that there are carers and loved ones, and also that there are health providers who are also humans. So we believe it's really important that, you know, the staff experience and the patient experience are inextricably linked, so it's a very much a part of our work to support the services as well as to support consumers. So if you look at our, you know, technically, if you look at our contract with the health department, it has individual support services and sector support services.
So maybe if you could reflect as you're speaking this morning, just on patient expectations, but also what you know of staff expectations through that engagement process, and also what you kind of found through the sustainable health reviews process specifically, because that was such an intensive, you know, long process and with deep engagement, and then what you're finding from your Health Consumer Council experience, which is not part of the sustainable health review. I know that's a bit difficult to tease out, but I think it's important for us to know kind of where you're getting your views. Was it just through that process, or was it wider and for longer periods of time, which just coming through kind of consumer views generally?
And I just wanted to check, Sharon, are you talking, you know, here also about environmental sustainability specifically, or just in general, the engaging more generally?
Yeah, so the sustainability issue is being talked about for a long time.
Yes.
In the environmental space.
Yes.
That's the obvious place to start.
Yes.
And to be keen to hear your views about how patients see that environmental sustainability piece.
Yes.
But there's also a more recent focus on climate change.
Yes.
And how that relates to that sustainability agenda.
Mm.
Now, clearly, part of the inquiry is about reducing the emissions footprint of the health sector, but also the waste footprint,
mm-hmm.
which is slightly different.
So I wonder if it's useful if I start with looking at the Clinical Senate debate on waste. So the Health Consumers Council role in that is we have a seat at the table going on to the debate, and we're in the executive advisory group that organises the debate. So what was interesting to me was that that was really largely framed through the lens of eliminating waste as in unnecessary tests and treatments. But what also emerged from throughout the day was that there was opportunities to make, you know, a lesser environmental footprint. So it was, you know, as distinct from talking about clinical waste. And so in the Clinical Senate, for those who are not aware, there's an opportunity for people who attend, who are clinicians across the sector of all hues, to develop recommendations. One was particularly articulated that says the system manager produces a benchmark report annually across hospitals for key waste areas and makes reports publicly available. So the concept behind that was that there was quite a lot of activity that I wasn't aware of before I went along to that debate that different area health services are doing to reduce waste, you know, the single-use items and so, you know, a range of different things. I wouldn't be across the whole detail, but there was, you know, quite a lot of work that happens, you know, in a way that's pretty opaque to the public. But anyway, that opportunity was that there would be a report that would be publicly available. But that recommendation was not endorsed. And so I guess for me that's a pretty strong signal for the system. It is perhaps not a current priority. I would reflect too that with the Sustainable Health Review, that it was of such a massive breadth of topics. And I think I really would like to recognise the contribution of Jamie Ellett-Farrant, who was on the Consumer and Carer Reference Group for the Sustainable Health Review, for the fact that it continued to make it all the way through to a recommendation. I think it can be very difficult to keep that at the top of the list. In terms of patient expectations around waste, I'm not really convinced that people really have a very high expectation of our health system as having a role around waste, and they probably don't think about it that much. And I think in part that connects to, if you're really unwell and you're really sick, it might not be top of your mind as the thing that you're worried about. You know, people tend to worry about their clinical care. People do tend to feel concerned about how they're treated. You know, as a human being, that sort of thing will be very much top of the list. But I'm pretty sure that you're aware here around the table about the patient opinion platform. So that's an independent moderated platform across the nation, and West Australia has been the leader in its implementation. So that is an opportunity for people to jump online and tell their stories. Now, we only found 3 stories that you could conceivably connect with environmental waste. So there was one actually from New South Wales. which I thought, which was talking about food packaging. And, you know, we're happy to provide that link. It's, you know, it's in the public domain, but basically the person said, in this day and age, aren't we supposed to be reducing plastics? I sat in, every meal came with plastic cutlery, orange juice in a plastic disposable cup. And the trays are all disposable as well. Every day the bin was full of plastic. Can't we do something different? So the response, people may be aware that the response from the health service is also available for everybody to have a look at. And it talks about, you know, I can confirm that we are committed to recycling and all our plastic items are fully recyclable. Unfortunately, due to food safety regulations, we are unable to reuse the same cutlery. Additionally, infection control concerns prevent the use of jugs for the serving of juice. I do appreciate your feedback and can assure you that we are committed to responsible waste management. So there's that immediate tension between infection control and, you know, single use and all that sort of thing. So I think that's I felt that was a common theme running through the clinical senate debate as well. We did find a couple of other stories. There was one in WA, because that first story I quoted was from New South Wales, but there's one in country southwest, and it was again talking about the plastic waste on the tray, and the response said, you know, an important part of delivering quality care is a strict approach towards maintaining infection control and meeting patients' individual dietary requirements. So I think, you know, again, there's that pushback from the system around that, and we did have somebody complaining about hospital food as well as waste, so the ongoing thing. So I hope that really, just to summarise, there's two things, you know, that I saw. There are things happening in the health system that are largely opaque, I think, to the public. And it would be, we are very passionate about the importance of transparency and changing practice. And had that recommendation from the clinical senate debate been implemented, I think you would have seen a greater uptake of waste management practices. And also with the public, not a huge number of stories on patient opinion relating to waste, but those that were there tended to have a response from the system around focusing on infection control.
That is helpful. I'll just make a couple of comments just in response. One is that you mentioned considerations around food safety and infection control, and I think it's right to say that there's always a balance,
yes,
between, you know, environmental impact, cost, infection control, or between packaging, food safety, etc. And a lot of the submissions we've received say it's time perhaps to rethink the balance. Not to say that any of those considerations aren't important,
correct,
but maybe we made those decisions a few years ago, arrived at a position which has now become kind of historic and current, but the context has changed, so we just need to say, have we balanced that off correctly as a risk issue, and is the response proportionate? So it's actually helpful to get the stories you've just given us. We've got some around infection control, but that food safety, food packaging issue we haven't heard before. And clearly the issue of food waste is also very significant and written about. So these stories coming back are important.
Yes, Karen, and the Health Consumers Council would contend that there could be some fantastic opportunities in partnership with health services and consumer and community, and preferably with some, you know, expert input to tackle that problem again and decide together what the new balance could be.
And just to reiterate that everyone is concerned with good clinical care and
absolutely
good patient outcomes, but there may well be ways to get to those same good outcomes or even better outcomes, you know, and still meet good economic, environmental and social considerations.
Agreed.
You do, and I also take your point about the patient opinion survey, and thank you for taking the time to get those stories out. But could it also be a question that unless you ask, you may not find out what people's views are on this issue?
Oh, yeah, Karen, I would agree with that. And as I say, it can be difficult you know, I think it could be difficult. The cohort of people who are sick and seeking treatment may not be the best people to engage with. It may be more of a broader community focus, you know, and potentially partnership with local government. Who knows? You know, that kind of concept of perhaps going to the healthy public who may have more bandwidth to have a look at those issues. I don't know. I mean, each hospital and health service will have a consumer advisory council or a district health advisory council. There's some good talent you could work on within the hospital, and I do wonder if it's something that is perhaps a broader community interest and could be approached slightly differently.
And we have had feedback from some of our public forums that patients in rehab, for example, are more concerned about this because they've been in the system for months, some of them, and actually have now got the time to give feedback. So just letting you know that. But thank you again. You've given us some ideas about where further consultation could occur. So that's helpful. With respect to staff expectations, we have heard fairly consistently through the inquiry that staff are trying to do the right thing environmentally at home, and there's a gap when they come to work, and there's a cognitive dissonance, that's the term that's been used, which is becoming of concern to staff.
Yes.
They want to be able to work in an environment where they see people are trying to do the right thing environmentally. And it's not immediately obvious, you know, why there should be so much waste in the health system.
Mm.
Is that something that's been reported to you?
I will be honest and say it's not been top of my list, but as I say, it can be difficult in the health sector when there are so many things competing for attention, and that is what, as I say, what I've felt throughout the Sustainable Health Review, and without the champion that we had, I think we would not have ended up with anything like what we've had.
You talked about patient opinion. I think that's different from tools to measure patient satisfaction on an ongoing basis.
Absolutely it is, yes.
Could you just outline the difference?
Oh, it's really interesting. This area of human endeavour is constantly changing. You may be aware, for example, that the NHS in the UK have for a long time been collecting, you know, the friends and family test data. Would you recommend this service to others? And after a bajillion bits of data, I think they're kind of wondering really what change it's making. I think there's other tools perhaps that might be more effective. But it also depends on what the tool is for. Say, for example, in our state, we have the patient experience of health survey, the PEHS survey, and that's perhaps more at a population level, and that may have some benefit, although it does largely exclude people who don't speak English and people who don't have a fixed address. So we've had a long head equity concerns about that. But it's, from the Health Consumers Council's perspective, there are perhaps limits to how effective widespread surveys might be. I'm wondering about something perhaps a bit more targeted where, you know, a health service takes it on as a bit of a wicked problem and perhaps includes their local governments, for example, who you know, work very much in that space of waste recovery. And, you know, the people perhaps who are in their patient groups already, but also people who may live in the suburb who are not sick. But, you know, say, for example, I live near Fiona Stanley Hospital and I construct my hospital. And I would be interested in going along to something around waste, even though I'm not attending there as a patient. So there could be a bit of a different approach. But those things, they do take some resourcing and time. And as I say, it's very, very hard when you're flat out trying to stop people dying to put this at the top of the list. And this is what I find over and over again can make it difficult. And, you know, that's why I guess I really welcome the resources that have been put aside towards this so it can still, you know, have some bandwidth. It's really interesting to hear your reflections about staff feeling that cognitive dissonance between how they want to behave as citizens and how they have to behave at work.
Can I ask, you're obviously connected and talk to other health consumer bodies across the country. Has this come up, this issue come up in any of your national discussions?
Interestingly, no. We've been very involved in medical devices and patient safety issues, I must say. However, it's something that I will certainly be raising at our next meeting.
Thank you. Can you, you did help hold a workshop on the 7th of October with the support of this inquiry, I'll put on the record. It was held at Health Consumers Council. Can you tell us about that workshop and what was discussed?
Yep, it's Claire Mullen. We had 16 people register for the session and 10 attended on the day. When we asked people what was of interest to them and what had brought them there, many of them commented about a personal interest in the environment and climate change, and also some people commented on their increasing awareness of the health impacts of that. They talked about physical health impacts, but also mental health impacts. When people were asked about the impacts that people are seeing or experiencing, a number of people commented about concerns about rising temperatures, and the impacts that they spoke about seeing was that it limited people's ability to get outdoors and exercise, and also to connect with their neighbours in their community. Children spending less time outdoors playing, and that impacting on their physical and mental health, particularly with a focus on reducing childhood obesity. People talked, there was a bit of a theme about the increased impacts that there are on people who are from less advantaged backgrounds, more disadvantaged backgrounds, and so, for example, people having to make decisions about whether they can afford to have the air conditioning on alongside other household expenses that they might be juggling. And the increased health risks for older people and people with chronic conditions of rising temperatures was mentioned. With regards to that issue about spending time outdoors, that was also highlighted with regards to, impacting more on some communities than others. So some people commented that, you know, some areas are leafy and have lots of wide open spaces, and others have less tree canopy and less shaded open spaces. And there's often a link between those two and, for example, housing affordability. So it could be that people who are looking for more affordable homes are in areas with less tree canopy and less wide open spaces, and therefore have more challenges at spending time outdoors. There were concerns raised about environmental events such as bushfires, coastal erosion and rising sea levels, particularly impacting, for example, on Torres Strait communities. And they talked about the loss of biodiversity impacting on the health of the land, as well as the potentially negative impacts of fracking. The mental health impacts were mentioned by a number of people. They spoke about, one person commented about lying asleep worrying at night about her grandchildren's future. And others spoke about particular groups experiencing mental health impacts because of their connection to the land. And Aboriginal people and farmers, for example, were particularly mentioned. There was, however, also some discussion about some of the positive impacts that in recent times, for example, that the people coming together as a community to tackle some of these issues, and also, for example, young people's involvement and their activation in the Skill Climate Change Strike, and community groups, local community groups, bringing people together to discuss how communities can reduce their environmental impact. Potentially similar to the experience of staff, people there spoke about a number of actions that they personally are taking to reduce their impact on the environment. They spoke about talking with friends and family, taking action at home about, you know, water tanks and solar panels and so on. But also they talked about things that they're doing at a community level, so getting involved in community activities such as community gardens, or also talking to neighbours in housing complexes about how to grow more veggies in those areas, and also getting involved politically to encourage action. With regards to the impact that people thought health services could have, one strong theme was the opportunity for the health services in general to collaborate across government to ensure that the human health and the environmental health impacts of all government initiatives are considered. For example, new infrastructure development, town planning, building regulations and industrial activities such as fracking, and try and apply that whole of government approach. Similar perhaps to the comment that was made through the Clinical Senate, there was a suggestion that perhaps the health services could undertake a number of audits. They could audit the use of energy and the use of materials to identify and share opportunities for improvement, a suggestion of moving to electric vehicles. And again, similar to the comments that came through patient opinion, there was a comment there about the possibility of composting or fertilise or using food waste to create fertiliser, or perhaps using other ways to use leftovers, for example, partnerships with groups for homeless people. There was something specific about ways that the health service could support people in communities to reduce their health-related waste. So we had one person there whose daughter has a disability and uses PEG feeding tubes. And so, for example, when the PEG feeding tubes are changed, then the syringes that go along with them are no longer able to be used with the new PEG. And it's not possible for those to be given back to health services. The person is just told to dispose of them. And so, for example, that person is taking action to connect informally with other people who might be in a similar situation. But if there were some support available to enable community members who find themselves in that situation to make it easier to ensure that equipment like that is being reused. The other suggestion was around Webster packs being able to be reused rather than replaced each time. And there was a comment about opportunities for the health system to continue and build on initiatives around health promotion and linking these to environmental health. So suggestions like facilitating sessions with tenants in housing complexes where people can share ideas about how to reduce, reuse and recycle, which would have the associated benefits of Act, Belong, Commit benefits too. And particularly also taking action to talk with people in vulnerable groups, because that was a really strong theme, that recognising that some groups are potentially, this is an added burden alongside other burdens. There was a comment that recognised that many of the actions that could be taken really might need to take place at a place level, and that the solutions may differ from place to place, and so the opportunity to work with people where they are in community, and a genuine co-design approach where all parties come to the table ready to be, you know, with equal positions at the table. And there was a comment also recognising the role that businesses have and the necessity of them being involved too. But people did also comment that there's an opportunity to tap into the community interest in this space and encourage positive action. In terms of some of the potential barriers, people commented about the lack of easy access to clear information on sustainable alternatives, and I would imagine that is also an issue within health services too. I know, for example, I had seen an example from an interstate of changing the kidney dishes, from throwaway plastics to recyclable compostable materials. But I imagine that some avenue by which it's easy for both people who work in the system and people who use the system to find out about potential ideas and how they're working. And I guess for me, one of the themes that came through was the recognition that some of the solutions lie in that community. So in community, in bringing people together in order to build on the assets that exist both within the health systems, knowledge and expertise, and within the community to help people connect and ensure particularly that support is in place for vulnerable groups to deal with the impact of climate change.
So thank you. So you're almost saying, I'm just struck by that phrase, in community. So it's not just that solutions are in the community, but they're also in community, meaning they're in the process of bringing people together.
Yeah, that for me emerged from that and from other conversations I've been part of in this space, is that the collective nature of the of bringing people together, yes, has its own benefits.
Health Consumers Council has a particular role with vulnerable groups and specific expertise dealing with different groups in our population over a long period of time. So maybe just thinking about what you've said, Ms. Mullen. Ms. Brennan, can I just ask you to reflect on engagement in terms of going forward with, first of all, say, culturally and linguistically diverse groups? There has been some recent articles saying that migrant and ethnic communities feel a bit left out of this climate change debate, and we're just starting to discuss what we can do as an inquiry. Is there any advice you'd give us about how we might engage with culturally and linguistically diverse groups, but also with youth and with other groups that tend to not have a voice?
So certainly in terms of cultural and linguistically diverse communities, at the Health Consumers Council, we don't like that hard-to-reach phrase, but prefer the hardly reached, because actually people are easy enough to find if you're willing to go out to where they are rather than expect them to come to your West Perth office at 10 o'clock in the morning on a weekday. So I think those sort of general principles of seeing if you can go out to where people already are and have conversations with them in places that they feel comfortable. And there's so many fantastic organisations, for example, the Isha Multicultural Women's Health Centre, who, bring women together already. They may have bicultural workers so that you've got less of the language barriers. It's just about being somewhat creative and linking in with everything that's already there. I think youth is a particularly important cohort. As the parent of a soon to be 21-year-old, I'm only too aware of the specific anguish that young people experience that somebody, a Gen Xer like myself, doesn't. I do think, again, there's so many great opportunities already there. I mean, say, for example, Claire's already talked about community, and again, if he's in community, there are already lots of fantastic youth groups there. There could be important partnerships in going and talking to people and developing things that actually work. I do really feel a strong call for something local government / community organisation level. There's, I think, a lot of opportunities to leverage resources in different areas to bring those sorts of things to help young people be part of something practical and achievable.
That's a very positive message. So you're basically saying the groups are out there, you just need to go and engage with them and go to where they are rather than...
It's our experience usually that people in the community are much more ready to engage than people in government are.
Thank you. Do you have a specific remit around the aged care sector or people
who
are
elderly? We don't have a specific, obviously there's a range of important organisations like, Council on the Aged WA, Advocare, so they do individual advocacy in that space. But we do advocate for older people who are stuck in hospitals, and as we know, that happens quite a lot, and it's something that's very, very, very close to our heart. We have certainly been really trying to do something around bringing to life the recommendations from the Sustainable Health Review in relation to the aged care sector. We've been pushing quite hard for the use of the Care Opinion platform to work in that space. But in terms of environmental, it probably hasn't come to the top of our list, but I know it's something for us to consider.
And we are getting some feedback that this is an issue for the young, yes, for adults, yes, but also for grandparents. And that was one of your comments you made earlier, Ms. Mullen. And that's, I think, a bit, it's coming through in other ways as well. People are worried for their grandchildren and the longer term. There clearly is a need for ongoing engagement. These are complex issues, and everyone is grappling with them, both in terms of roles and responsibilities and how much of a priority issue this is. And that clearly might change over time if we go forward, and seems to be changing, if you look at the last years.
Absolutely.
So is there a role for Health Consumers Council to partner with other organisations in terms of thinking this through?
Well, I think there's always a role for not-for-profit organisations to be seeking to partner. The Health Consumers Council does have a seat at the Supporting Communities Forum, which some of you may be aware of as an intergovernmental state-based forum. So it has Directors General of Health and Education, Police, Justice, Community, and I may have forgotten one. It also has not-for-profit organisations at the table. It has four Aboriginal leaders at the table, and I sit on it as a consumer.
I think it's an important mechanism for bringing together the state around these issues. What is very difficult is there are no incentives at all for government to share their dollars and share their outcomes. So that's really what the Supporting Communities Forum has been really trying to work on. How can we make the, you know, delivering community services and partnership policy real? It has, in my opinion, focused perhaps more on the government, non-government relationship and very much needs to also include the consumer and community at the table. But of course it is a great mechanism for progressing shared outcomes. It's done a significant amount of work, you're probably aware of, developing outcomes for our state. So that's been a specific project. They also align with the McGowan priority. So, you know, that whole thing of outcomes being studied and the positive and being the whole of human reality. So it's really looking at how can we create a better state.
Could you just, for the record, the Delivering Community Services and Partnership Policy, I'm aware, has been there for some years as a policy framework. If you could just perhaps remind me how long it's been there and how long has the Supporting Communities Forum been established for?
So the Supporting Communities Forum, sorry, the policy, I believe, off the top of my head was 2012, but I would need to check that. It has just recently undergone a review. I think it's always really important, a policy is a policy and reality is reality. So there is often a bit of a disconnect between what it says on paper and how people experience as a not-for-profit, you know, having a service purchased from government. So it's been really important to keep it as a focus. The Supporting Communities Forum was formed by the McGowan government and it looked at what the Partnership Forum had done before and tweaked and improved it to create the Supporting Communities Forum.
Another thing that emerged from the workshop that we held was that climate change and health, immediately people also started to talk about family and community and economics and employment, education, built environment, and so that interrelationship between, you know, it signals it as one of the complex wicked issues, and so the if you like, the opportunity or the need for leaders at all levels from all perspectives who are comfortable with that complexity and some of the discomfort that comes of working in complexity really, I think, stood out for me, and potentially some of the limitations of a traditional government approach with its built-in administrative processes and hierarchies and so on, that a forum such as that brings lots of different players together to try and do something differently and in the process of doing it differently. But it was striking, I think, how much people, you know, all of those issues, if you like, came up when that issue of climate change and health was mentioned.
Would you like to, so you said that it's a complex issue and that's its a leadership challenge. Would you like to reflect a bit on the nature of the leadership needed? Are there any particular models of leadership that are suitable to this kind of problem? That are not the hierarchical leadership models?
I think it's the opportunity for models that work alongside the existing kind of, you know, hierarchical models, and how particularly people in public servant roles or public sector roles can play their role at the boundary of their own organisation. But if you like, going into, as we've talked about, going to where people are working within different structures. There's some work that I think has been led by the University of Birmingham, but which also the Public Sector Commission brought here, looking at the 21st century public servant. And there's some interesting parts in there about, you know, public servant roles being around, you know, navigators, networkers, and particularly our interest in that space of engagement about engaging with humanity. And again, going back to that point before about the person-centred nature requiring that whole holistic approach for both community members and people employed in organisations.
We've just got a couple of minutes left. Is anything based on this? We've had a conversation, which is great. I've got a lot of useful information from you and specifics about particular forums and groups that are existing that could be part of, you know, how we consult further. But having just reflected on this conversation on the forum that you held at Health Consumers Council, does anything come to mind even that you'd like to say now before we close, even if it's something that strikes you as opposed to a definitive statement about what we should do, given we've had a good discussion about this?
I think really linking it to that element of sustainability, that the most sustainable system is one, our health system is obviously one where fewer people need to use it because of ill health. So and certainly in conversations that I've been part of, many of the practices that focus on environmental sustainability also have benefits for human sustainability in terms of social connection, physical health, and other mental health benefits. And so I guess that's when I reflected on the discussion that we had and in preparation for this, is that connection between people as individuals, people within community, and the natural environment, but the opportunity to perhaps relook at that balance is a possibility that I think would have benefits for the health system as well as the individual to use and work in it.
Ms. Brennan?
I think it's pretty hard to top that. I think that really says it all and caps it off perfectly.
Okay. Can I just return to the way where you started, which was around clinical standards and
yes.
waste?
Mm.
So it's very interesting because there is quite a lot of material written that suggests some of the most important environmental impacts we can have is actually in that reduce and reuse, but particularly reduce. So anything that actually diminishes kind of waste in general and not just environmental waste, so reduces duplication, minimises the need for admissions to hospital, shifts care into primary care and the community, is actually some of the most environmentally important interventions you can make. So maybe it's all part of the same conversation.
I would agree, and I think the high value healthcare work that's happening, it does overlap with this. And of course, I'm very passionate about informed consent. Most consumers don't really understand what their choices are, what models of care they should follow. I think some of the key messages around, it's okay to ask and do I really need this test or treatment? I think the work in that space of community being able to make more informed choices is really important and has a really important sustainable thread.
Thank you both for your attendance at today's hearing.
Thank you.
A transcript of this hearing will be sent to you so that you can correct minor factual errors before it is placed on the public record. If you could please return the transcript within 10 working days of the date of the covering letter or email, otherwise it will be deemed to be correct. While you cannot amend your evidence, if you would like to explain particular points in more detail or present further information, you can provide this as a submission to the inquiry when you return the transcript. Once again, thank you very much for your evidence.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thank you.